This is the MCrit Podcast, where we bring upstairs care downstairs. Hello, Scott Weingar here, and welcome to another episode of the MCrit Podcast. Last week, we started talking about trauma, and we specifically spoke about the critically ill bleeding trauma patient. And we mentioned trauma-induced coagulopathy, a disease state that is in some ways similar to DIC, but happens just from the tissue injury of trauma and from the bleeding that results. And that leads to hypothermia, acidosis, and coagulopathy. And they all beget each other. And then we come along and dump in a whole lot of lactated ringers, and we dilute everything out and make things worse. We keep our patients cold, and we don't fix their perfusion deficits. So the triad just keeps continuing until they spiral down into an irreversible state of multi-organ failure and eventually death. We don't want that. We also spoke about our blood pressure goal, which some folks in the literature are referring to as permissive hypotension. I think that name is horrible. It makes it sound like some experimental concept where you're letting a patient be hemodynamically unstable for good purpose. But that's not what it is. I mean, we have that in medicine. We have permissive hypercapnia, where we let the CO2 spiral into very high levels, and we say that's okay to protect the lungs. But that's not what we're doing. What we should be calling it is probably just sufficient normotension. Just sufficient normotension, because that's exactly what we're doing for the patient. We're letting them stay at a MAP of around 65, which is the ideal place for a critically ill patient's blood pressure to be, because you're not vasoconstricting and lowering organ perfusion. But at that point, all the organs are getting the blood supply they need. So just sufficient normotension. MAP of 65 is our goal. One proviso to that, which we should have mentioned last week, is in your head injury patients. If you think a patient has increased intracranial pressure, you actually want a MAP of around 80. And you'll really fight hard to get them there, because inadequate brain perfusion, not such a good thing. So if the patient has lateralizing signs, if they have the depressed level of consciousness, then make 80 your MAP goal until they have some kind of ICP monitor in. All right, in this episode, we're going to say what to do when that MAP drifts below 65. And essentially what you're going to do is you're going to give them some wet stuff. And the question becomes, what wet stuff to give and how to give it? Well, let's talk about the last point first. You need good IV access in these patients. Now, this has been perpetrated through ATLS. We all know this, and two large bore IVs happen even usually before patient evaluation sometimes, which is not a good thing. People seem to have this goal of getting the IVs in when really it's not the thing the patient needs when they first roll through the door. And what large bore actually is depends on your center. When I was in the ambulance, we used to put 14 gauges in. That was large bore IV access. Now it's 18 gauges at the center I'm at. And that's okay, because honestly, two working 18 gauges are worth a whole lot more than two big hematomas around some 16 gauge or 14 gauge IVs. And if you have an 18 gauge in, you can pretty much do whatever you need to do, because as you'll see shortly, everything should be under pressure anyway. But if you could get a 16 in there, you're sure it's going to go in and not blow the vein, then knock yourself out. But these peripheral IVs are kind of crap when you're dealing with a really sick patient. They have a tendency to blow, get dislodged. So if a patient's really sick, they should get a cordless introducer or a large bore central catheter, like a dialysis catheter that's nice and short, and you stick into the subclavian vein. I'm really not a big fan of these femoral lines, especially in a patient with very low blood pressure. You can easily wind up in the artery and not even know it until the patient's blood pressure comes back. Blood's the same color, it's pumping under the same pressure when their MAP is 30. So stay away from the groin. And if they have a penetrating injury to the abdomen, never go into the groin. If they have an IVC injury, you're gonna look pretty silly when all the products you've transfused go into the abdomen. So subclavian's the line of choice in trauma. If there's penetrating trauma to the chest, you go on the opposite side. You don't give me this crap about, well, there's probably a pneumothorax there, we might as well go on the same side. Because again, if they have an injury to their subclavian, not going to look so good to put the line in that side. All right, so now you have your IV access. You have a nice cordis in the subclavian. And one of the questions that came in from last week's show is, do we need an arterial line? And if the patient's sick and you have the time, slipping in a radial A-line is a very nice thing. When you're monitoring that patient in the OR or the CAT scan, having arterial line is enormous for knowing what's going on with that patient. So if you do it, great. And if the patient's really sick, if their MAP's in the 30s, then they need a femoral line because the radial is not going to cut it. So what are you actually going to put into that cortis? Patient's blood pressure's low. Well, ATLS would tell you, you put 2 liters of crystallite in, and in most places that's going to be lactated Ringers, before you even consider giving other products. And here's what I'll tell you. You get a patient that's not that sick, maybe they just have a slight drop in their BP, you want to see if they respond to fluids. Okay, 2 liters is okay. But in an actual sick patient, 2 liters is way too much. That is just making the problem worse because the crystallite does nothing really good for these patients. So what I would tell you is if you have a sick trauma patient, the way you play it is you give your crystallite, if you're going to give it at all, in 500 ml aliquots, and you do it under pressure. Everything needs to be under pressure. You need to see the results of your fluids in real time. And if you have a pressure bag that you've pumped up to 300 millimeters of mercury, or better yet, a level 1 fluid infusion device, which will both pressurize and heat those fluids, that's even better. And what you do is you stick the 500cc bag in there and you turn on their pressure, or you pump up your pressure bag, and you watch the patient's MAP. And if it goes above 65, you stop the fluids, even though there's only 500cc's in that bag, because they don't need the extra for all the reasons we spoke about in the last show. So on a sick trauma patient, they come in, they're not looking so good, I might give 500cc's of crystallite while I'm waiting for the products, but probably no more than that. Crystallite is not the answer in these patients. So what you're going to be giving them is blood, FFP, and platelets in a 1-to-1 ratio. This is what's come out of the battlefield research overseas, and there's been some trials in the States too. The evidence is by no means conclusive, but most of your major trauma centers have moved to this just based on the observational trials that are already out there. So the concept is for every unit of packed red blood cells, you're giving 1 unit of FFP and 1 unit of platelets. And the idea is you're trying to replicate, though not fully successfully, whole blood, which is probably the best resuscitation fluid if there was actually accessibility and no problems with infection. So how does this actually work? Well, obviously, you're not going to give 1 unit of platelets and then 1 unit of FFP and then 1 unit of packed cells. It's not really how it plays out. What happens is if you have thawed plasma in your hospital, and specifically if you have AB, type AB thawed plasma, then for your first delivery, you could ask them for 4 to 6 packed cells and 4 to 6 FFP. And you actually can give those 1-to-1. And if you have a level 1 transfusion device, you could actually give 1 unit of FFP and 1 unit of blood at the same time. If you don't, you just give a unit of blood followed immediately by a unit of FFP. Most platelets come in apheresis packs, or they come 5 to 6 units at a time. And so what you do is after you get in about 6 units of red cells and hopefully 6 units of FFP, you give them a pack of platelets. And that platelets are usually fairly low volume. They go in very quickly. And then at that point, you've matched 1-to-1-to-1. And this really is the ideal resuscitation from the perspective of most of your academic trauma surgeons for the initial resuscitation of a bleeding trauma patient. Now, you don't go overboard with that either. You don't take them beyond the MAP of 65. So the idea is you just use that to moderate your blood pressure. If their MAP goes much above 65, that's when the fentanyl comes in. You start building up your sedative package and you start getting rid of the patient's innate vasoconstriction. So you really know that their blood pressure represents perfusion. Now, there's some names for all this. This concept of 1-to-1-to-1 generally has been called massive transfusion protocols. And the idea is that if a patient requires replacement of their blood volume multiple times, they also need replacement of their clotting factors and their platelets. An overall name for everything we're talking about is damage control resuscitation. This all came out from the concept of damage control surgery. Damage control surgery is the idea that what used to happen to a trauma patient is they'd get taken to the OR and they'd have every single injury repaired and they'd be in the OR for a few hours and they'd come out and their belly would be closed and the patient would die. Not good. So what a few folks figured out is that if you take them there and you just do the bare minimum, you just take out any organs you need to, you stop any major bleeding, you staple off without reconnecting intestinal injuries, you pack instead of carefully sewing any oozing vessels, and you leave the belly open, you cover it temporarily, and you get the hell out of the operating room. You take the patient to the ICU and resuscitate them. You fix their lethal triad. They did much better. They actually lived through their operation. Next day, back to the OR for definitive management. That's damage control surgery. Well, the same concepts feed down to us in the ED. We should be doing damage control resuscitation. We should be getting them out of the ED as soon as possible to definitive management. We shouldn't be making the lethal triad any worse, and whenever possible, we should be making it better. All right, let's talk about some other products that you might have heard about. What about cryoprecipitate? Well, most people would say cryo should be part of a massive transfusion protocol. The real question is, when it comes in, is it given empirically? Or do you manage it based on lab tests, like, for instance, a fibrinogen less than 100? And I'll tell you, in the ED, don't worry about the cryo. That's really something the sick you guys have to worry about, so don't concern yourself. You stick with the 1:1:1, and cryo will be later on. What about factor 7A? Everyone was talking about this for a while. Studies have been conflicting. I don't think factor 7 has a role in the ED at this point. I think it might still have a role in the operating room after they've gotten the patient's pH up and they just see this horrible venous oozing that can't be controlled with anything. Maybe factor 7 still has a role, not in the ED. Now, the one product I think has an ED role is prothrombin complex concentrate. This is a concentrated form. It's about 20 cc's to 40 cc's. You give this and you get a whole bunch of vitamin K-dependent clotting factors. It's in dry powder form until you reconstitute it, so there's no thawing problems. I think this might be a solution to the problem of no availability of FFP when you first start your protocol. In most places, thawed FFP is not available. They have to defrost it from scratch. That takes about 20 to 40 minutes, and you've already lost that 1:1 PRBC to FFP by that point. So if with your initial delivery of packed cells, you got some prothrombin complex concentrate and gave that, you'd be, with a very low volume administration, be basically repleting the important factors for clotting. Now, there's only been studies in swine so far, but I think that on the horizon might be the answer to the initial damage control resuscitation in the ED is packed cells, PCC, platelets, any other stuff we need to know. Okay, well, we mentioned crystalloid, mentioned lactated ringers. If you have a brain injury patient you're resuscitating, switch to normal saline. They could use the boost in their sodium. When I was training at shock trauma, we only used plasmalite for pretty much everything. Plasmalite's a great fluid that pretty much replicates plasma. Is it worth the extra expense? I don't know. But it doesn't have any lactate in it like Ringer's does, so in a patient who has shock-induced liver dysfunction, you're not going to have a falsely elevated lactate. We used lactate to screen for all sorts of badness there, so we like the plasmalite. One thing that is on the horizon, and I think will eventually wind up in ED, is hypertonic fluid resuscitation. Things like hypertonic saline, with or without big sugar moieties like dextran, with lower volumes, less dilution, have the same increase in blood pressure as much higher volumes of regular normotonic crystalloids. So you might see that in the future. The last thing I want to talk about is calcium. If you show an experienced trauma intensivist a low blood pressure, usually the first thing they'll reach for is calcium. Be cognizant of it. All of this transfusion we're giving the patient actually either chelates their calcium or dilutes it out, and you need calcium for good inotropy. Give calcium. I can't tell you exactly when, but be cognizant of it. I often, when a patient starts dropping their blood pressure in a trauma situation, will reach for a gram of calcium chloride if I have a central line, and you can give one or two of those without having to think too much about it. Beyond that, go by lab testing. All right, I think time's up for today. Trauma topics in the future, we got to talk about trauma airway. I think I'm going to try to have a guest speaker with me on that one. I want to talk to you about the upcoming ED Critical Care Conference in New York. It's January 13, 2010. We have some incredible speakers. If you're in a residency in New York City, tell your program director to come. If you're not in a residency, send me an email. We'll work it out and get you an invite to the conference. Each year, it's been better and better. This year, we have speakers like Vladimir Kabedin, Mike Winters, myself. We're going to do another Sim Wars. It's a good time. And the cost is right. For residents, it's free. Just a little bit more about the MCRIT universe. We haven't really spoken about this. If you're listening to this podcast, you know about blog.mcrit.org. But have you gone to just plain mcrit.org, the web text of all things ED, critical care? Take a look. Let me know what you think. And then the last site, which is actually linked on both of those sites I just mentioned, is the MCRIT lecture site, learn.mcrit.org. And that's a site where I just put lectures and procedure videos. Take a look at that as well and let me know what you think. All right, I've gone over time for this week. I look forward to speaking to you again. Bye-bye.